You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Caravan of Love, the best venue at Greenbelt, and thanks for coming along to this rescheduled session, which was originally going to be on Friday. We've got Sarah Clark, who's going to talk to us about eco-theology. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, and it's really great to have you all here. So I'm going to introduce a little bit. I'm not suggesting people don't know about eco-theology, but I'm going to go for audience participation. Who's up for that? Bit of audience participation? I love it. And I've got two guests with me. I have Ruth Wilson on my left, who is from
Petcord Forest Space,
Which is just outside Birmingham. And I have John White with me, who is from
Hazelnut Community Farm in Bristol.
Oh, no, hang on. We didn't... Right. Are you ready, Kim and James?
Petcord Forest Space.
There you go.
And then there's Sarah Clark from CMS. Gosh, now we all feel good about ourselves. So I'm just going to have a little look today. I like the words environmentalism, eco-theology, ecology. There seems to be a lot of terms that we use. And then we have green church and greenwashing. And the chances are you know as much, if not more, than I do. I teach the undergraduate program in Pioneer Ministry degrees in theology at CMS, and one of our modules in the third year of our degree is on environment and justice, and we look at the environmental church and the thing and look at what a theological response to the environment is. And one of the things I get incredibly passionate about is I think we have gone from this position where we thought about the environmental crisis, and now what can the church do? As if somehow it was this other thing that we then have to go and look after. Whereas right at the very beginning, written into the story before the beginning of time, was this idea of eco-theology. So I want us to look at that today. What is this idea of eco-theology, which actually has a massive impact on every single thing we do, and it isn't just a case of environmentalism. I'm going to suggest today that environmentalism is just caring about the environmental crisis. There is nothing wrong with caring about the environmental crisis, but this is just seems to be this kind of one transaction that's going on between us and this idea of crisis on the earth. But eco-theology is a massive whole world living, whole people living, whole creature living, whole cosmos understanding of theology. And I'd argue it is the theology. It's the beginning of our theology, is eco-theology. We were not created separate from the earth. The earth is not this separate thing that we have now screwed up and have to look after. It is part of who we are and how we operate and how we exist. And we're going to have a look at that type of existence today. And the reason I've invited John and Ruth to come and join me is because they have tried to embody within their way of being, within their church life, this idea of eco-theology. Has anybody heard of Laudato Si? Can anybody tell me, does anybody want to shout out what they think Laudato Si is? It's something written by the Pope, for those of you who don't know, Pope Francis. Sorry? Oh. An encyclical, right? What's an encyclical? Sorry? It's a letter to the church, and the Pope, writing on behalf of the Catholic Church, is actually writing it to all Christians. We can all say he is our Pope. Anyone else got anything to add to what Laudato Si might be? The summary of the film was that the Pope is kind of trying to give us a whole world understanding. What the Pope has been calling for is an eco-theological conversion. Because we, like, does anybody want a tiny bit of history about how we've got to where we've got to from the eco standpoint? Would that be helpful? So, thinking about the world, there is this chap called Louis Dupree, and he talks about what's called an ontological synthesis. So we have creature, creation, creator, right? And we all can look at one another to know who we are. So I am made, we are made in the image of the Creator. So we can look at ourselves, the good bits of what we are, and we can look at God to find out who we are. We can also look at creation to find out more about who we are and how we should live. And so there's this kind of conversation that goes on all the time between Creator, creature, being us and animals, and creation, being all the stuff that's around us. And I don't know if any of you went to the talk yesterday. It was called The Uncontrolling God. And he was talking about God as love and God being uncontrolling, and that there's a certain amount of mystery and there's a certain amount of enchantment when we think about who God is. But we have kind of made God in our image, and all we've put at the center of our image is ourselves. And we've largely forgotten about creation and, in a lot of ways, creature. And so God has just become this God that we kind of understand as an extension of ourselves very often. And at the point of the Reformation, we kind of got systematic and scientific, and we lost the idea of enchantment and mystery. And the idea of enchantment and mystery helps open up the space for us to think beyond ourselves, to see the cosmos, to see creation as a way of finding out who we are, and even to look at the Creator and find out who we are. So one of the very beginning, there is a biblical scholar, and she said right at the very beginning, when creation was created, God talked about it as wisdom. He talked about it as the female person of wisdom. These people are going to tell us something about the place they are, and they won't be able to, because I've spoken to both of them. They can't quite put their finger on what happens when they take people out into nature, which I want to call creation because I want to attribute it to the Creator. And they say something happens when you're out here that feels almost magical. They did this experiment in Sweden, and there was a bunch of kids that had got the equivalent of ASBOs, or they'd been chucked out of their schools, or whatever had happened to them. And their IQs were low, their attention to school was bad. They kept them in a forest, doing all sorts of things in forest, living in there, enjoying the forest, going around, observing stuff. At the end of the months they were there in the forest, their IQs, every single one of them, their IQs had gone up. So there is something magical about creation that we can't quite put our finger on. And this scholar wants to take it back and suggest that it's something to do with the Creator's wisdom that sits in creation, but we need to use some other part of us to kind of engage with that and to understand it, because it's a little bit mysterious. It's a little bit beyond our kind of current imagination of just looking at the things we can see and make sense of biologically, the things we can see and understand because we've learnt about them. But there's something about this experience of being out there that we can't quite put our finger on. And I'd suggest it's something to do with this wisdom of the knowledge of how to live well that sits in creation. I want to suggest something else. We live in a Western context where we're all about the individual. And if we go a tiny bit beyond the individual to the family unit. And we largely do our own thing in our own way. And now with this whole, I'm not trying to say this is wrong, but the whole, the truth's in me, I'm living my truth, is a very individual way for us to live. And if we're all living our truth, it makes community really difficult. Because to be in community, you've got to live a community truth. But, and also a community truth, not everybody's equal. We've all got different things going on. And community requires a sort of mutuality, a mutuality across genders, a mutuality across people that are non-binary, a mutuality across orientations. We're all allowing space for one another to be different, but we're deciding to come together and hold some core values together. If we look out at creation, it offers that. It offers it to us. If you go in, and has anybody heard of the mycelium network? The mycelium network, for those of you who don't know, is a way of the forest feeding each other. So you can go into a forest and the biggest tree in there that has the biggest access to the nutrients in the forest, the biggest access to the sun, all sorts of things, often is the oak tree. And the oak tree feeds, it gives its stuff it doesn't need to the other trees around it. The trees also communicate to one another. There is a scholar at UBC in Canada, University of British Columbia, and she discovered that they talk to one another. And when there's a crisis going on or a disease going on, they tell each other and they send each other almost kind of antibiotics to try and care for each other. And they send it to different species, not just their own tree. If you go to a riverside, two plants that often fight with each other, or one might take up more space than the other, it doesn't behave like that when it's by the water. It allows space for the plants that can't get to the water to get to the water. So what I'm trying to say by saying all of this is there's something embedded within creation. It isn't just this mysterious experience that we have of wisdom, but there's also a kind of blueprint on how to live well, on how to do mutuality well, on how to share resources, on how to alert and care for one another. And I'm not saying that humans don't do that. I think we have lots of very good examples of how we care and protect and see each other. But I think if we just, all we see in creation is a beauty spot, if all we see is something that we need to look after because we've screwed it up, it's way more than that. So within our churches these days, we have what I'd like to call shallow eco-theology, where we just think we're going to just buy a few things, do a bit of recycling, call ourselves a green church. But I want to suggest we want to go further than that and talk about being a deep eco-theological church, when we start understanding that very written right into the story before we began is this inherent relationship between creator, creature, and creation. That we are all intrinsically linked. And we can't be fully human unless we are linked to creation, unless we're linked to creature, unless we're linked to creator. That there needs to be this understanding that we're all linked together. So it's about earth care and people care. If you want to know more about this, reading anything from the Pope on Laudato Si, my goodness. I don't know if people want to move closer. There's Laudato Si and Laudato Deo to read. But I've done enough talking now. Does anybody want to come back and say anything? If not, I'm going to hand over to these guys. I know I asked for participation, but I've not done that. Yes? Do you want to come up to the microphone?
Yes, I just wanted to say at the service, communion this morning, you talking about how we are all one. I just saw this couple embrace for a very long time. There was clearly a lot of distress between them. And they were about as far away as that tree. And my heart went out to them. And I bet you most of the people here would have done the same. We are so connected. We so care about people, even people we don't know.
Thank you. I also did mean to say this is being recorded, so if you're happy to come up to the microphone, you're going to be kept for a while. Did you want to come up to the microphone?
So it's a bit of a curveball question. I went to a talk yesterday with someone from Lawyers for Nature, and he was talking about dominion and how in the legal context that's sort of been used in a negative way. And could you say something about the original meaning of dominion, please? Thank you.
So dominion has been a long kept word, and that has often, there is a guy called Lynn White who really held the ecological crisis at the hands of Christianity, saying the reason why we've got it is because we've had this dominion or stewardship and just thought the earth was ours to take as we want. But actually, the word is not dominion. If you really look at it, Adam was Adamar, which means from the earth. And the term that is also mentioned in Amos, and it's the first one at the very beginning, is carer for. So we have been asked to be carers for. So just as much as we're made in the image of God, we are also imago Dei. This is also made in the image of God. And as image bearers, we do what the Creator does by caring for. So he said to us to be carers for, not have dominion over. But we have used these words very badly. Cultivate is another word we've used quite badly, because we've taken it to mean that we can do whatever we like. One of the ways, so I'm hoping when once these guys have chatted, some stuff will come out. Permaculture, I think, is one of the few ways where it's really showing us how to work with creation, not against it. Because we think tilling the ground is a good way to look after it, but it actually really damages the earth. So we need to think, when we think about the word dominion, what it really means. We're caring for. So if you're caring for, creation has to have a voice. Because often if you care for something, you've got to know how it needs to be cared for. So listening to the earth, finding out. So this isn't obliterating science. We're not excluding environmental science when we think about the earth. But we want to think about how to care for it well, which means we need to also listen to it. We need to be in communion with it. We need to be in relationship with it. So that's where I go back to that idea of the creator creature creation. It is a synthesis of relationship. So environmental science isn't about just undoing the damage we've done. It's about really listening to the earth and changing our relationship. So that's why I call for a whole change of relationship in church, not just to start doing a few bits to become an eco-green church or greenwash things, but to actually think deeply about this relationship of care and listening. How does God care for us? How does he listen to us? How does he participate and cultivate and work with us and ask us to be in communion with him? So this lady saying it's about communion, I think it's communion with everything. It's communion with one another. It's communion with creatures. It's communion with creation. And so we have a change of the way we operate and think. If we want to hold Christianity responsible for the word dominion, we want to hold responsible those who misread the word. Because we are Adam. Adam are. We come from the earth. So we are part of it. We're an intrinsic part of it. We didn't just happen to be on this earth and we can do whatever we like to it. We are intrinsically connected to it. And so as part of it, we are caring. I'm going to step out here. It's almost like we are caring for kin. We are caring for creation kin. Was there anything else? Or we're going to move on. There is Q&A at the end, if that's okay. Did you want to come up? And then we're going to move on to John so I can give them time.
I really love everything that you're saying, and I really love all of the move towards a greater embrace of our kin in the natural world. And I think that often those on the front line or doing pioneering work or Fresh Expressions or anyone leading things are really, really trying their best. And then the protocols of administration, of like the big institution, the pressures that are on those administrators to mow the lawn, tidy the hedges, clear out the badgers, is so unfair. And I, like, every day, I know it sounds like trite, but I pray for those administrators to gain the strength and the courage to push back against these lines of protocol that they have to follow, to say, we are also responsible for caring for our kin in creation. So just anyone who's ever felt frustrated with their diocese for making them mow their lawn when they want to rewild, instead, pray for those people who are under pressure to follow budgets, to follow the party, follow the kind of methodological line, and hope that they can also find the strength to step in to that care.
Yeah, which is what I think is the difference between deep eco-theology and shallow eco-theology. Right, we're going to hold over to John now to shout at us about hazelnut farm. Can I have a big round of applause for John?
Oh, thanks. So great. Well, I'm going to take a moment to share about kind of my climate conversion and how that happened, a bit about what we do at Hazelnut, and then a bit about how you can engage with Hazelnut as well. Yeah. So I can you hear me now? Is that better? A little better. So I did not grow up or did not come from kind of a switched on eco background. I came from America where it wasn't talked about in a kind of a conservative evangelical church. It was joked about when I was growing up, kind of eco things. And then I came over and had a first conversation with somebody who was doing a PhD in kind of green eco-theology. And I said, I'm a new person to this. Can you explain to me how I can begin to engage with this? And his response was, it's too late. The earth's going to burn. And it just shut me down for years because I thought, well, how do I engage? Like, I was asking and there's no way to engage with this. What do I do? So it was only kind of years later, well, really about 5 years ago, I went to a city farm, and it was just a beautiful day, and I brought my kids there, and it was stunning. And I've been reading a lot about kind of older monastic communities and how they engage with growing and welcoming people to stay at their land and all these holistic ways of living. And I just saw it worked out in the city farm. I saw it in the city farm. I saw it being completely engaging with a wide range of races, a wide range of ages, a wide range of just the whole thing. And it wasn't weird. Everyone was just engaging and fitting in. And I thought, this is a city farm is the modern outworking of a monastic community. It just needs like a bit of a spiritual center and core as well. So I took that kind of idea. Well, I had that, and at the same moment that I was having this idea at this Windmill City Farm in Bristol, I had this climate conversion where all of a sudden my eyes were open, and I thought, not only do I need to engage more with creation, but this is the single greatest issue that I will face for the entirety of my ministry, and I won't even see the end of it. It's just for the time that I'm in. So I need to throw myself into this wholeheartedly. Which meant that I went back to my vicar at the time, because I was just a training curate, and I said, I want to start a city farm. And his response was, well, that's very interesting. Are you a farmer? No? Very, very interesting. Anyway, they in a very nice way, Britishly, said no, but because I'm American, I didn't hear it. I just said, okay, we'll do it anyway. And so we started having a go. And really, it kind of realized that a city farm was such a big idea, but a community garden was something that was a doable first step. So it took a long time, but we started Hazelnut Community Farm. And kind of the idea of Hazelnut is that we are making earth, making creation, that again, that triangle that Sarah was talking about of creator, creation, and community as a key member of our church. So what we're not doing is taking traditional church and bring it outside and putting it in pews and music, you know, like we're not putting up microphones and playing guitars, yeah? We're actually saying earth, creation, is like our brother and our sister, is a member of our community who we are engaging with and learning from and co-learning from. And so that has changed kind of the way that we look at it. We've also thought, because of this initial idea coming from a community growing space, we started growing vegetables as a key part of engaging with land. And I think that's been really important for us because what we found is I believe that growing vegetables is one of the key ways to engage large numbers of people to awaken up and have a climate conversion. And I'll tell you why. Because even if we encourage rewilding, which I think is good, or we do things like eco church, which I think is good, I'm not criticizing these things. You can kind of do these things and walk away, but if you've ever grown something, you can't. You think tomatoes are nice. They're not. They take a lot of time and energy, and there's blight, and there's, you know, you can't plant something and walk away and not look at it. You have to go and attend to it, yeah? And when it's not raining and it's blistering hot, you can feel the groan of the plants. You can feel the groan of the earth. When it's too wet in the spring, you know it because you feel it because the plants, the earth is telling you and they're responding to it. And so you have to begin to see earth and attend to it. And so we found that that is a great way for us as a community to engage with it. But also our commitment is to give away 50% of what we grow. And that way we're not a growing club, but we are involved in and engaged with our community and giving away food to members as well. Yeah. So that's part of what we do. We do things like it's been interesting because it started with this idea of climate emergency, but it's grown so much deeper as we've engaged with Earth over time. I think our eyes have been opened to a much deeper theological reality. So an example is, and I think this is a personal one for me, is prayer, how I do prayer. I find that it is difficult for me to sit quietly in a room with my eyes closed and say words. I feel that my prayer is now through my fingertips, engaged in earth, and I'm directly involved with Creator God in earth. And so when I'm growing something, when I'm in creation, I'm not just being there and enjoying the beauty of it. I'm actually seeing it as a work of prayer and life and worship all together. And that's really impacting me. But for me, it's not minimized. I feel like the old way of praying is actually minimizing me, whereas engaging with prayer in all of creation has, in a sense, opened up new realms of prayer for me and has increased and grown the way that I pray and worship. And our community, and Bryony's over there in the hat with the heart on it. Bryony is wonderful. She works with me. She does not have the loudest voice. When we gather outside, we gather in our community and we do prayer as a community. She always says, okay, we're going to be quiet and we're going to listen now. And the minute she says that, there'll be alarms going off in our community because we're in an urban setting. There'll be people shouting down the road. And it's really funny, but there's also the bird song and the wind in the trees. And we say all of that is our listening to our context. And we hold all of those things in our prayers. So prayers become this listening exercise and then engagement in action as well. Another reality that I think has been important for us as a community and for me as well is really once you're beginning to see prayer worked out in land, and then you find that you're co-creating and co-existing with creation rather than, like, again, having dominion over it, or even stewardship is a word I don't like, because again, it says that we are the ones who are in charge of earth. What we're trying to say is that we are co-existing together and living together rather than caring for it. You know, it cares for us as much as we care for it. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of what Sarah was saying earlier. But what has kind of opened up my eyes is that how rife kind of the Gnostic heresy is within the church today. And this is a bit controversial, but the Gnostic heresy is that this belief that the earth doesn't really matter, and that you'll have a series of spiritual encounters to buy you out of earth into a spiritual reality. And I guess my critique of the church is that we are in a passive Gnostic culture where back in the day, things were created because everyone was living an agrarian life and wanted to leave it to have a spiritual life. And now, few people are having an agrarian life and everyone's having kind of working in buildings. And we go into churches and we're trying to have these spiritual encounters and there's no theology of earth at all. Yeah? So an example is communion. I think it was built so that you could go and there was an altar and it was holy and it was separate and it was honored and Jesus would come out from the back room. Again, I'm talking Anglican High Church. Do you know what I'm saying though? If you really think about it though, and it's set up to honor, but in a modern context, it's distance. It's away from us. There's no incarnation involved in the way that we do communion in a traditional, maybe higher church. And so what we do at our communion is we do it on a picnic table, and our holy areas are on a picnic table, and to embody Creator, creation, and community. So we literally have our community sitting at the picnic table. We have our tools of work. We have what we harvested there. It's all there. And then we have our space for the community as well. And then we take the bottle of wine before it's been prayed for, and we hide it in the beds, in the growing beds, and the kids have to go find it. And again, that's a symbol of incarnation. Christ comes into earth. Yeah? Christ comes in and honors earth that was created. And that's kind of what we do as well. So we're trying to break through from this Gnostic thing and actually say that creation is a vital part of our lives. And actually, how do we live an ingrained life that I think a lot of what Sarah was talking about as well. So I guess this is the last thing I'll say as well, as my time's probably coming up, is that the other thing that we've done is we've really sought to share out everything that we've done. I think we're really living in an age where collaboration has got to be key. And we've got to work together because the problem is so big and hope is so sparse. And so the more we work together, I think we can create interesting places of hope. So what Hazelnut's trying to do is we're trying to help churches start their own eco-congregations in the land that they have around them. And so we're creating resources and supports and networks to be able to do this. The idea is what if every church was not known just as a place of worship, but was known as a place of land transformation, where you could come and you could have a peace garden, where you could come and you can have local bread that was made there, where you can come and you can be fed from the garden, and it was a place of beauty and peace and of land. And each church was a microcosm of a land engagement that linked up with all the other churches. Yeah? This could be the most beautiful thing. What if in an age of climate emergency, Christians were known as the people of land? What if we were known as people of incarnation that lived and made land holy? Rather than trying to escape to heaven when we died, we made heaven come now here, and that's the gospel of incarnation. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, without a pause, I think I'm done.
Thank you very much, John. And we're going to have a chance to ask questions of John and Ruth at the end. But I just want to introduce Ruth. Ruth, I'd love for you to just tell us about your the community project that you're involved in and how you got to be involved in it.
Hi, everybody. So I'm a Methodist presbyter in the Bromsgrove and Redditch circuit, which means that I'm responsible for buildings and rotors and all of those things, compliance, the stuff which saps the energy out of me, to be honest. However, the Bromsgrove and Redditch circuit are the current management trustees of a place called Peck Wood. It's 19 acres of woodland, and that's just 12 miles from the city centre of Birmingham, just 6 minutes out of the town centre of Redditch. And this piece of land, this woodland, was gifted to the Methodist Church about 80 years ago, 1948, by a local Methodist, Mr. Patrick and his sister. They wanted to give a space to the Methodist Church so that the Methodist Church in the city centre of Birmingham could bring young, back in the day, 1948, they specified young boys, but now it's for young people, to come out of the dark satanic mills into the fresh and open air of Worcestershire. So for nearly 80 years, Peck Wood has run as a youth centre. There are cabins and there are bunk houses, and it's all a bit rough and ready, but it is absolutely glorious. And there's been generations of people who have come and been restored and enjoyed recreation at Peck Wood. And then in around about 2016, the Birmingham district issued a challenge to the whole district, every church, was to find a way how we could be a church without walls. And the Bromsgrove and Redditch circuit, we knew we wanted to do something, we weren't sure what that was going to be. So then time moves on a little bit, and then I went on a sabbatical. We had a global pandemic, and my sabbatical was all about meeting and being church outdoors. And somehow everything aligned. We were given some funding from Connection and from District, and the circuit was supporting it. And it was decided that 0.4 of my time, I was going to become a pioneer minister in the place that is Peck Wood. So alongside this youth centre, which has done marvellous ministry, there was going to be an intentional God space. And space is such... And the Peckwood Forest Space was going to be the working title, but I've grown to love it. And actually the space is the important part of that. And what Sarah was saying about creator, creation and creature, that relationship is what we try and live out at Peckwood. We have different communities that gather, some more intentionally God-focused than others, but they are always creation-focused. I always say to my churches, indoor churches, you know, tell me about a time when you felt like you could breathe deeply. Tell me about the place that makes you go, wow. Tell me about the place that you want to go back to if you want to be restored or renewed or refilled. And so often people will say, oh, well, it's a cliff, or it's a beach, or it's a wood. It's always, more often than not, outdoors. And there is something about that being at one with nature, about being outdoors, about being able to breathe deeply, being able to touch a tree, to ground yourself on the earth, which is, as Sarah said, it's hard to put into words, but it is I have found it to be a place of restoration, I've found it to be a place of recalibration. It is a place where people come and their shoulders drop and their lungs are filled. And it is a very special place and special things happen. And the best bit of all is that we're finding that people are coming along to the various groups that we run who would not step over the threshold of a church. And yet we are in the greatest cathedral that God has created. We are in a place where we are the guests. We are never the hosts. So the gatherings that gather, we have a seeds and saplings group, which is for under fives and their mums or dads or grandmas carers. And they come along and we get muddy and jump in puddles and things. That's great. We have a wandering and wondering session where people come just to literally wander and wonder. And then we gather around a picnic table and we share soup. We haven't grown the vegetables, unfortunately, but we eat soup and eat bread together. And then about 8 or 10 times a year on a Sunday afternoon, we'll have what we call forest church worship, which is very Celtic in its liturgy. And again, that if you know Christian Celtic liturgy, it is all about honouring creation. And we will talk about the moon, and we will talk about the sun, and we will talk about the trees. There is something very special. And so some people inside church, you don't go worshipping trees, do you? No. We worship the one who created the trees. And some people say, well, I'm not a tree hugger. It wouldn't do for me. Well, I've tried tree hugging. It hasn't done anything for me, but I love seeing other people hug trees and it does something for them. Do you want to ask me another question?
What I'd just like to hear from both of you as well is, so often there is this, I mean, I think, you know, you're here, I'm assuming, because you care about eco-theology. You may have come here because you don't know enough and you want to know more, but I'm assuming most people care about it and that's why you're here. And I think there's been an echo in both voices here from John and from Ruth that actually it has, you know, you think one of the biggest industries going on right now is well-being. Mental health has skyrocketed. I'm a lecturer. I teach an undergraduate program, and all of the people that I have interviewed to come start in September, every single one of them has told me about some fairly serious mental health issues. And I don't think that's just because they're pioneers, although pioneers tend to be slightly other, so have things going on. But I think there is a rise in mental health. And I think that's largely to do with, if you read any Wendell Berry, it's about fundamentally going back to a disconnection from who we are and a disconnection from the land. And you don't actually need resources when you go to the land. It does it for you. It has all of the majestic power within it. And so Ruth's just sort of said, you know, these wandering and wanderers, which I absolutely love that term. You know, it's about deep breathing. You think you could go and do a session on well-being and I'm sure it would be well done and well curated. Or we could spend an hour going through wandering and wandering in the forest. Yeah, and I know, you know, the forest isn't available to everybody. We've got to remember in a lot of places it's quite a middle class thing, having availability to a beauty spot or being able to get out to the country. I used to work with children who were infected or affected by HIV in London. Some of them had never left their council estates and they're in their late teens. So it's not available to everybody. But we've got John here in an urban setting who's managed to co-opt with his great American style and miss out the English no and get that piece of land and do something with it. There is bits of vacant land all over the place. So there are things that we can do to change and to embody and to embrace. But I want to make the argument that eco-theology, if we don't have eco-theology, if we don't fully understand it, we are going towards death. It's not just death of this planet we're on. It's death of self, because we are intrinsically, we cannot disconnect from the land. Our disconnection from it has caused all sorts of problems. Now, you know, I'm aware I'm truncating a lot of I'm an academic, so I'm aware I'm squishing a lot of arguments together here, but I'm just wanting to go for the big picture. So I think big picture messages, we are intrinsically linked to creature, creation, creator. And unless we come back to that synthesis, it's a problem. Now, I think resting on a lot of people's shoulders is the ecological crisis. A lot of young people are carrying that weight, and it feels as if nothing good's going to come. But we need to all club together and start doing small, tiny things. I'm not suggesting that Hazelnut Farm is a small, tiny thing, but it's a start. What Ruth is doing is a start. What I'd like to do is invite people up if they have any questions. We've got 20 minutes left and we'd love to involve you. So if you've got some time to come up and share something that you're doing or you've got a question, as we've heard with many talks, what's it? Patrick put it beautifully. He said, you'll get up and ask your question, which is really long. And at the end, you'll say it's a comment. He said, and we all love that. So don't come up and ramble long time, but do come up and share and say a little bit about what you're doing or ask questions of these two would be great. If there's anybody, and just remember we're being recorded, so, you know, nice, cool questions would be great.
So a lot of what you've been saying kind of echoes things that people like Brian McLaren and Richard Rohr have been saying as well. And there are companies who are now putting nature on the board and giving nature a voice, which is, I think, is brilliant. Very similar to. And what I'm wondering is... If you were talking about the switch in the Reformation and how we kind of lost that spiritual angle to understanding the role of religion and faith and so on. And I'm wondering, what else can we relearn from other faiths around the world that would help us with putting all of this back into, you know, back into our own faith?
We have so much to learn from indigenous communities. I detest the word indigenous, by the way. I think, you know, it takes people out as other. But for the sake of it, I'm going to say non-Western societies, we can learn so much from them. When I was in Vancouver in Canada, the First Nations, there's an absolutely phenomenal book, and it's called it's something like Taking the Gospel Back from the Cowboys, written by a man called Richard Twiss, who's a First Nations writer in Vancouver. And he talks about how the First Nations, their deep understanding of that relationship between ourselves and the land. I also, it sounds like I've lived in 7 countries, so he keep hearing me say, when I lived in India, I met people there that they don't talk about the environmental crisis or how to care for the earth. They're not separate from it. They're not separate, but that's mainly because they're low paid people working on the land. But their understanding of self and the land is so much richer. So there is so much to glean from other, cultures from other places. We think we've got the answers here because we've got technology. We have shifted away from the answers. We have, you know, it's ironic. I work at CMS, the Mission Society, where one of our groups is doing pioneering parishes, teaching churches how to be missional. And I'm like, since when did we lose what it meant to be the church in society, to be missional? When did we lose what it meant to be intrinsically connected to the earth? The fact we're having to relearn these things, but we think in the West that the whole of theology has lost it. That's not the case. But we have stolen largely in the West the theologies from other countries. India has stopped being India in its, you know, the Indian Christianity has got a richness to do with the earth, but we have co-opted it, squashed it with colonialism. We've done the same in Africa. We've done the same with the First Nations. The First Nations were ripped from their homes and put into these residences and made to be British, made to be English, and lost their culture. So one of the gifts as well I think we have to gift back is we need to gift back the ability for all nations to have their version of Christianity. And their version of Christianity is deeply entrenched in their culture as it is entrenched in ours. Systematic theology is a Western theology that has outcast, got rid of, eco-theology. So we have much, much to learn from other countries. We have much to learn from countries that have embedded and kept their faith. If you go to First Nations, their faith is not separable from the land.
If you go to, I went right up to the very top of Canada, where it's still snowing in April, May, they have like 300 odd words for snow, you know, because the land means something to them. So I think going back to other cultures is really important, because with the rise of science and systematic theology, we lost that connection and went for mainly salvation theology only.
Two thoughts just from our experience as well. So we've got over half of our communities from Hong Kong, which has been a real gift for us. And early doors, what we've realized is that actually you can express physically what you believe internally. And so we've decided to grow food from around the world, not just for the British appetite. And so we've got tomatoes next to bok choy, and it represents how our community is, and that we want to see our community ingrained wholly rather than divided out. And what we found by having this gift of all these folks from Hong Kong is that one of the unifying things across the world is nature. Even though we may speak a different language or have different cultures, growing is essentially the same everywhere. So our common language is creation. And so that is a unifying factor we've found, and it's been a really blessing for us. The other thing that's been really interesting is as we've grown, really, again, noticing that monoculture, as in one plant, one field, we know that degrades the soil and is bad for society. Whereas the more rich you have plant life and diversity in things that you're growing, the more rich the soil, the more rich the wildlife and everything. And so in a sense, that is how the land itself, is, especially personally me, taught me about inclusion and about that the more flavors and the more people and the more diversity, the better and the richer community you have. And land teaches us that. And the more monoculture you have in your church and in your culture, the weaker your community is going to be, because it will degrade the soil, your own soil of your culture. So land teaches us about what it is to be inclusive.
Yes. So I've got a question here, and then one over here, and then one back there.
Yeah, sure. It's a wondering about church politics, I think. Sorry. So we've heard in your wonderful conversation a critique of a Christian faith, particularly in the West, particularly in this country, that on the whole is dominated by Gnosticism, by a kind of otherworldliness, and by individualism. I'm part of the structures of the Church of England, for better or for worse. My sense is that the centres of power in denominations like mine are captivated by a Gnostic individualist kind of Christianity. And everything that we've been talking about in this space is somewhere kind of near the edges. It's kind of a fringe, interesting activity, you know, a bit of fun, but also, you know, maybe has a connection with some wider climate issues that, you know, aren't the central focus of church life. Whereas what we're saying here is that this is utterly central. This is right at the heart of what Christian faith is about, of what God is about. This is where we encounter the true God. And so that sounded a lot like a sermon, but my question for all of you really is, with what energy and time and capacity, with what kind of voice do you speak to the wider church, or want to, or can be bothered to speak to the wider church?
I have to say that I find it hard not to be passive aggressive when people in the circuit say, "How's it going?" And I want to say, well, you know, there's one way to find out is come along and find out. For Peckwood Forest Space, where it's early days, in 80 years looked after by the circuit, but Peckwood Forest Space only 18 months or so we've been working and gathering people. You know, it is going to be a slow process, but let's look at the trees. How long does it take to grow an oak tree? And there's something about we need to model slowing down. So what we're saying is we look at creation and we can learn stuff, and maybe we need to model to our church structures and to our congregations, it's okay to slow down. It's okay not to see results, whatever results are, immediately. let's just carry on doing what we're doing, making a start, and breathe deeply, listen, notice, and take that listening and noticing that we do it. I mean, I can't count how many dragonflies I've just seen this morning. You know, notice the dragonflies, listen to the rustling of the trees, hear those birds singing like we did in lockdown. They're still singing, but we just don't make time anymore. I think there's something about modelling, slowing down, listening, and being patient with ourselves, and let creation teach us.
I think I got a couple of ideas on this. I think the first is, as I think it took a long time for me to realize I was waiting for permission to do this, and I've got to do it even if I don't have permission, and I want to just have to go for this. And so that has been costly, but it's meant that we've been able to do this, and I'm encouraging other people to do this as well. Kamala Harris just recently talked about breaking in America, in her whole thing about breaking walls, and she said, you've got to break things, but you have to know that you will get cut sometimes. And I just think there is a reality that pioneering and starting new things means that you do break walls, but you'll also be cut a little bit. And I think for that, I think collaboration has to be huge, where we find common voices and we support one another. So Hazelnut, we are wanting to engage in this and start a movement of churches using their land. And so we're trying to get churches to use the resources they already have to do this. But we also are, because we may get cut doing this, we are seeing ourselves not as in competition with Eco Church or Messy Church or God's Acre, but in collaboration with all of these things so that we can create a common voice and eventually have something that is pioneering now become the norm in time. I think that's the dream, really. So I'll say this too, is after this, I'm going to be around to talk to people about what we're doing in terms of trying to start a movement of churches doing this. So I'll be around, and I'll be at the CMS stand.
And I think largely there is a retraining that needs to go on, because we can't just expect people to think that they want to do this and get involved. Like, my main area of research is philosophical aesthetics. And I make an argument there that we all need to be engaged in creativity or art in some way, because it's what it makes up being a human. And if you go to the art gallery, we all want to read the stuff because we don't know how to embrace or engage ourselves in art anymore. I don't know if you remember when they had Ben Fogel and all that lot, and they chucked them all on some island and they screwed up because they couldn't do it. You can't just go straight into community, where we largely live as individuals. There needs to be steps that take us slowly to something. So our expectation of people getting it and wanting to be involved needs to be relatively low. But the more things we put on, the more experiences, and people love experiences these days. And if you wrap it up in the language that makes sense, you give them what you think they need and that what they think they want, and then you get them over the bridge to what you know they need. But use the want language. So it's like, here's the world as it is, but here's the world as it should be. You want to operate in the world that it is. So it's starting where people are at, listening to them, using the well-being language, using whatever you've got as resources over here to help people to come over to here. Does that make sense? And then I think also we need to have, like, I'm speaking at the clergy conference, which I cannot bear the thought of, cause it scares me, in London in October on this subject. And I will be saying at the very beginning, one or more of you might be offended at the end of my session. Because you just need to know that you're taking risks to step somewhere, because it's a bit like the red-blue pill. Everybody swallowed one pill, and we're asking people to realize it's a different reality. And we've got to walk into that reality, and it's slow, and it's gentle, and it's local. Local, I think, is a massive key word here. If we can't impact, and we need to be transformed. If I'm not fully transformed, I've got no hope to transform other people. So as we are practicing and being involved, so we help other people to practice. Does that answer your question from us? And Sophie, I think you had a quick question. Then we'll have one last one over there.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about whether one of the reasons this has been decentered is because we've lost a theology of the body. Because a lot of what you're saying is about coming back into our bodies, into our senses, right? Whether it's creativity or getting back out in nature. So whether it's Descartes, I think, therefore I am, whether it's Plato, whether it's the church, I work as a mental health practitioner. Until people come back into their bodies, they don't start connecting with creation around them. But when they come in, they're like, wow, I'm part of this bigger thing. So I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that.
100%. I think that is, again, part of the fruit of a Gnostic reality, in that our body is not honored and it's not seen as spiritual or life-giving. In a sense, we're trying to escape our body. And it's just really interesting, again, to encounter Christ who comes into earth and lives this earthly reality, not just to show us how to get to heaven, but the honoring of the physicality in the body is such a beautiful, beautiful truth. I suppose, too, it's not even, I think, again, seeing the body, though, as connected to all things is important as well, in that my well-being is not just for my well-being. My well-being is your well-being, and your well-being is my well-being, and the earth's well-being is my well-being. Do you know? And I think that's the next step, because I think, in a sense, it feels like culture is beginning to talk again about how important we are as individuals, but we're not making that next step, which is to the collective, and we're all embodied together, and the goodness is for all of us. Creator, creation, and community.
And I want to just say one last thing on this individual, busting the myth of individuality. Our bodies don't exist on an individual basis. We've got little critters, although I must say when I was 8 and I found out little critters lived on my eyelashes, I went home and chopped my eyelashes off. But we are, you know, this idea that we're individuals and just work for ourselves. So I'm not trying to say that this I'm living my truth is a bad thing, because I think a lot of people do need to have space, mental health and all sorts of things. But I think if we take that too far, we're in danger. We really need to. The Ubuntu says, I am because you are. It's it comes from Africa, and it's this idea that we're all deeply connected, which we are. This idea of individualism. Craig Gay wrote a book and said the churches are, this goes back to you, autonomous individuals. He calls it practical atheism, because we are deeply connected. So we're deeply connected to self, to body, to land, to creator, and we need to start bringing these connections back. If we are not fully living that ourselves, it's a problem. So we need to also do an audit of ourselves to find out how well we're living in this.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed your contributions very much. And I was wondering how we kind of take this forward, because the church seems to mean lost in a spiritual monoculture, you know, which goes back actually to the very roots of its origins. You know, you have this battle with an otherworldly, not disconnected kind of spirituality is right there in the roots of the church, isn't it? We have to acknowledge that. So it seems like I'm part of the CAV accidentally, as it were. I quite enjoy watching what's going on. And you know, I see fully how disconnected it is, though. And so my instinct is we should keep the conversation going, because there are always people there who say, yes, you're right. When I say something, I find I do get people saying, you're right. You know, that's how it is. So I feel we shouldn't give up completely. But, you know, when even Pope Francis has to write Laudate Deum, which is really quite an angry document, saying, you know, that all these vested interests are slowing everything down. We're going 5 times slower than we need to. And yet, you look at the response from the Catholic bishops, they're not interested, really, in his message, in his own church. So I think we have to recognize that's the reality, and churches like that. His French theologian said, you know, Jesus came proclaiming the kingdom of God, and what we got was the church. So it's a reality. But I love what you say, and I think maybe just the answer is just, you know, Michelle Obama said, do something. So maybe we do something and keep the conversation going. I'm not sure that's a question, but thank you very much.
Well, just this is my suggestion to answer that. This is being recorded. So if you think other people would be interested in hearing any of this, or you feel like you need a language to be able to discuss it with other people, listen to the recording and share it in a group, or invite some of these guys to a Zoom call with your communities. Invite Sarah to a Zoom call with your community or to your church to speak on some of this stuff. that might be a good start. And maybe there's some books and stuff as well. But, you know, this is how you keep that conversation going, I think.
Yeah. Just to say again, I'm going to be at the CMS stall, is that we are creating everything that a church needs to get a eco-community in their land off the ground. We're doing the training, the resources, and the support to do it. That's our bit we're doing. It may not be for you, but if you want to know about that, it's a really practical way to do it. Come talk to me, and I've got an example resource, and I would love to connect with you as we get this off the ground and create a network of these all over the UK and in across the world as well.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us today. To those that have, I'm sure have probably come for Harry Baker, who's coming up next. But we appreciate you coming and listening to us talk about eco-theology. And do look on the CMS website. There's going to be a webinar in October on this subject. So big round of applause to Ruth and John. And me.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.